All right, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew 21. We're just about done with these prophetic sign enactments. We've had three. I guess it would be a good idea just to bring them back to mind. We're not going to redo all these. Today we're going to go to the fig tree, the withered fig tree, prophetic sign enactment. And we're going to notice some things about that. But it's a culmination. It's an interesting, if you go to Mark, Mark has a little bit different order. Mark is arranging things chronologically. He kind of goes day by day as he works his way through this. Matthew presents them a little differently. He presents them more thematically. And he presents them in a way that kind of progresses. And in Matthew so far, we've seen the first prophetic sign enactment. That was the first 11 verses in chapter 21. And they symbolically showed how God views the situation. And you have that, what I call the untriumphal entry, that ends not in Zechariah 9:9's rejoicing and shouts of joy and justice for Israel and the salvation of Israel. Instead, it ends in the whimper of ignorance, of unbelief, an untriumphal entry. He's not going to come at this time with rejoicing. It's going to come in weeping. And if we went to the account in Luke, we'd see right after this enactment, he weeps over the nation of Israel. It's going to be a time of weeping, not Zechariah's rejoicing, a time of weeping. So that's what we had in our first prophetic sign. They're not going to receive him. We talked last week about that steady progression of, I call it the devolution, however you want to say it, of the people's view of God, of Jesus. It starts with those two blind men in Jericho. It starts really well. They cry out, "O Lord, O Lord, thou Son of David." And what do? The multitudes rebuke them. The multitudes aren't rebuking them because, you know, they didn't think they should be interrupting Jesus, or Jesus has more important things to do than deal with them, or Jesus was talking to someone else and they were being rude. They rebuked them because they didn't want them to, those two blind men, to address Jesus as, "Oh Lord, oh Lord." They were willing, and we see this then in when they enter, they're, even when they quote the psalm and sing that, they leave out the "O Lord, O Lord," and just call him, address him, give him the praise of being the Son of David. Now, that's good. He is the Son of David, and they even recognize he's the Son of David in some way, coming in the authority of the Lord. But then by the time you get to the end of the second one, you go into that vain religious system, and they wouldn't even let the little children sing "Son of David." They're rejecting. The nation is rejecting him. In Jerusalem, the people cry out, "Who is this?" And remember, he's had roughly three years of earthly ministry. He's been proclaiming who he is. But the only people that recognize are those of faith. The Father, Jesus told Peter, the Father has to teach you who the Christ is. And Peter says he is the Son of the living God. Yes, the Son of David, but he's not one in a long line of sons of David's. He's not just another Davidic king. He's not just another prophet in the long line of prophets. He's the one prophet, the one Son of David, the one king who can solve all of Israel's problem, who can save Israel from her predicament, because he's also the Son of God. "O Lord, O Lord, thou Son of David." That's the full praise involved there. So we go from the first, the untriumphal entry, then we go to the vain religious system, the leaders in Jerusalem. He enters Jerusalem. What's Jerusalem? It's the headquarters for the nation, right? And he goes into there, and the multitudes are following him from Galilee. They're coming around that way. They're following him that way. And then you have all the people in Jerusalem, and they say, "Who is this?" They come out, but you know there's one group who hasn't come out to Jesus. That's that vain religious, the religious leaders. They're hiding in the temple. They don't even come out to greet him. They stay in the temple. So Jesus goes into the temple. And we have the second prophetic sign enactment there, where God symbolically shows how he views what's going on in the temple. And he does that, and Jesus goes into the temple, and I'm just going to say it briefly because we've covered this in depth in the previous weeks. He goes into that temple, and what's he do? He stops, he kicks out not just the sellers, but the buyers, the pilgrims, the people coming, the worship, the pilgrims who've come 100, he kicks them all out, the buyers and the sellers. And what does that do? That ends the flow of animals into that sacrificial system. He shuts down the sacrificial system. Then he goes to the money changers and he turns that upside down. What does he do there? He cuts off the financial lifeline to that vain religious system. The tax revenue that was demanded of every Jewish male at 20 years or above, they had to pay that annual tax. There was a place in the temple where they could come with their Roman money or their Gentile money, whatever it was. They come in there, they could pay their temple tax. Jesus takes that and throws it out. He stops the financial lifeline to the vain religious system. Then, if we throw in Mark's account, he explains that he wouldn't let anybody carry anything or move anything in the temple. He stops all the physical activity. He shuts down. It's not just a cleansing of the temple. He gives the divine view, the Father's view of what's going on in that temple. And his temple has been stolen away by a vain religious system, an unproductive religious system. And that goes into that. The only thing, he's shut down the temple now, symbolically and prophetically. And now the only sacrifice Jesus is going to see is what sacrifice? What's going to happen in a few days from here? Christ, the only sacrifice he's going to see is his son going to that cross. That's the only sacrifice he's going to recognize. And he's heading to those just days, and he's going to be on that cross. So that's the only sacrifice God sees now, is the sacrifice of his son. So let's go to the fig tree. Now, I went over that so you'd see how natural it is for Matthew to put the fig tree here, because he's going to talk about the withered fig tree. Now, where's the first time you heard about a fig tree in the Bible? Does anyone remember where the first time? Remember a little incident in the Garden of Eden, and somebody found some fig leaves to cover themselves with? And you have that's in the fall of Adam and Eve. They start with those fig leaves. It's the start of human religious systems to cover up what only God can cover up. And that's what he's going to bring out here. They're going to bring out, let's go to Matthew 21, and let's just read through. This is a pretty short one. Let's just read through this account. So the fig tree. Now in the morning, so we're on the second day now, in Matthew's chronology, or Matthew's how he set up thematically, he covered the first day. Now it's the next morning, and it's the second day. Now in the morning, as he returned into the city, he hungered. And when he saw, see, now that's an important thing, because what were you not supposed to find in Israel under the blessings of the law? There wasn't supposed to be any hunger. There was supposed to be so much food avalanching everywhere. How do they describe the kingdom? It's described as you have in the kingdom, there's going to be so plenteous food, no hunger, no thirst, no anything, and you're going to have to throw away everything in your cabinet so that you can bring in the new stuff. There's going to be so much. And he says here, now he hungered. There's not supposed to be hunger in Israel. He hungered. And when he saw a fig tree in the way, he came to it and found nothing thereon but leaves only. Now, maybe this a little horticulture lesson here. We talked about this briefly in the past, but what the fig tree does, evidently, I've never grown a fig tree, so I can't vouch for this, but I read this in a book. Evidently, what the fig tree does first is it sends out these flowers, and that forms a fruit bud. That's the first thing it does. Then it forms leaves, and then the fruit buds mature into complete fruit. It's kind of like I used to have a cherry tree. I've never grown a fig tree, but I have a cherry tree. And this weeping cherry tree, the first thing it got. Now, what do most plants outside do? Usually they get their leaves, and then later they send to produce flowers, right? And then they produce berries or whatever they're producing. With a cherry tree, what comes out first? It's not the leaves. It's the flowers. You know, you have those sprays of white flowers, a puff of white flowers that makes, I guess, even Washington, D.C. look pretty. And he sends those out first. And then the bees come and they pollinate it. And each one of those white flowers turns into a little bud, a fruit bud. Then it sends out the leaves, and then later in the season, later in summer, each one of those little fruit buds forms a fruit, a cherry in that case. Well, evidently, it's the same type of thing with the fig tree. It forms the fruit bud first, then it forms leaves, and then those fruit buds, by the end of the season, have developed into mature fruit that's usable. And Jesus, so now when you read this, when Jesus comes to this tree, he's looking, and there's no fruit buds. There's only leaves. Look how Matthew stresses that, but leaves only. So what does that mean? That means that shows him there's not going to be any fruit later because there's no fruit buds. Your fruit buds aren't going to form later. Their chance was before the leaves. Now the leaves has come, so there's not going to be any fruit on that fig tree in the future. So what does he do about it? And he says, and said unto it, let no fruit grow on thee henceforth forever. And presently the fig tree withered away. And when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how soon is the fig tree withered away? All right, so here we have the fig tree symbolizes Israel's religious system. Now, I know you listen to prophecy, so-called, I'm going to preface the so-called prophecy teachers, and they talk about the fig tree is Israel. The fig tree is budded in, 1947 when the nation. Well, see, that's just all nonsense. That's not what the fig tree is. The fig tree isn't the nation and the land. The fig tree is the religious system ruling in the nation. That religious system was supposed to be centered on God, and God was supposed to be working in and through that so that God could produce fruit in and through it. Instead, that it was usurped by that vain religious system, and God couldn't work in that to produce fruit on this through that fig tree with the nation. So he's going to go here. Now, God did everything he could do. And the fig tree is going to symbolize this. It's the religious system in Israel. It's not the nation as a whole. You could say it's the nation under, in this specific situation, being under this vain religious system. But it's not that specifically. It's a reference to the religious system, just like Adam and Eve in garden, covering themselves with the leaves of the fig tree that couldn't bear fruit. And that's where we are now in this. And if you see the whole progression here, enters Jerusalem, the headquarters of Israel, and they don't know who he is yet. They don't know, and that's really another way of saying they reject who he is. Because he's been there publicly ministering for about 3 years. They should have known who he was. He's got a group of believing remnant who knows who he is. They should have known. And they didn't, because not because he hid it from them, not because it was unknowable, but because they rejected it in unbelief. And now he goes to the temple. He shuts that down. He stops the inflow of animals to the sacrificial system. He cuts off the vain religious system's financial lifeline. He shuts it down. He takes what I would look at as he takes that vain religious system off its life support. And now it's just this gasping, wheezing patient in the bed. And now we go to the withered, and he's going to demonstrate it again by this withered fig tree. The withering of the fig, it's just going to die away. And we'll look at some details with that. So the fig tree symbolizes the religious system of Israel that God would use to produce fruit. Instead, it was sabotaged and usurped by the vain religious system, and God could not produce fruit in Israel under its control. And this brings up another point that we can never forget. This is, here we have an interdispensational truth. It's the difference between producing works through the flesh and their own, the flesh's power, and producing fruit, God producing fruit in and through us. It's a totally different thing. God never calls on sinners to operate according to the flesh to produce fruit. Can't be done. Fruit is produced by God working in and through us. The works that God accepts from the nation of Israel are not their own works through the flesh. Instead, it's the law and the flesh, but the fruit of his working in and through him. And this is just so much common sense. Just think, we've talked about this, especially in our Roman study. You can't fool God. God doesn't look at the work. What is he going to call this whole vain religion? A whitewashed tomb. You can't whitewash it. It doesn't matter how nicely you package the work. It doesn't matter how good it looks before men. It doesn't matter how nice the wrapping paper is, what nice big bows you put on it. No matter how... God's not fooled by any of that. He doesn't look at the work. He looks at where the work came from. And if it came from a heart of selfish interest under the power of sin and death, then it's not acceptable. It doesn't matter about the work. It looks at where it came from. If the heart's operating under God and faith and agape love and response to him in faith, and as comes out of the factory of righteousness and life through his son, then that work is fruit, and it's always acceptable to God. Just think about this. Remember, go back to the days of David and Solomon. You had the tabernacle and the temple. Things were running pretty good back then, right? God says, I accept your sacrifices. I accept your sacrificial system. I accept everything the priests are doing. Now they go to Jesus' day here in Matthew 21. And what did he just do in the temple? He shut them all down. Those priests in the temple were doing the same external works as those priests back there in David and Solomon. They were cutting up the animal. They were sprinkling the blood. They were doing all that stuff they were supposed to do. They were both doing exactly the same works, external works. What made in David's day that they were acceptable? And in Jesus' day, they weren't acceptable. Or in Isaiah's day, we don't even need to go all the way to Jesus. Isaiah 1, they're not acceptable. God doesn't look his, instead of being a sweet savor, their sacrifices just made them, well, this is what he says. Basically, I made him want to throw up. It was like stuffing his nose, and he just, what's the difference? They're doing the same works. The difference is in David and Solomon's time, they were operating out of a heart of faith. God was working in and through them. In Jesus' day, in Isaiah's day, for bringing on the fifth course of punishment, it was just a charade. It was just a game. It was just theater. And they were going through the motions while inside they were rejecting God and his word and rebelling against him. See, God's not fooled by external works. All the billionaires in the world today who say they're going to, I heard one, I don't remember which one it was now, but he's tried to give all his money away, and he thought that would give him a better position before God. He's trying to earn his way, and he's trying to gain a name in front of men. See, all the God doesn't go by that. If it doesn't come out of a heart of faith and love, then it's not acceptable to him. It's not God working in and through it. The only works God accepts from fallen humanity is the work he does in and through them, bearing fruit. He's not fooled by anything else. So now when we come to this withered tree, that's the status of this vain religious. They're carrying on all the external activities. They're lighting the censers. They're putting on the candelabras. Everything's going... But it wasn't acceptable to God because it didn't come out of a heart of faith. It came out of a heart of unbelief. So in trying to do it themselves through faith, through the faithless, vain religious system and its works, they end up rejecting God, doing it for them through grace and faith. And that resulted in this barren tree. Let's just look at a few Old Testament passages to show what Israel's supposed to look like. Let's just look at Numbers. We're just going to read through a few things here. Numbers 13. The point that I'm going to bring out here now is God has done everything he could for Israel, but she rebelled and rejected him and his word, and resulting in this barren fig tree. Numbers 13. This is the famous, we probably all learned this story in Sunday school. The spies that get sent into the land, they're outside the land, they send in the spies, and you had the 10 that were afraid to go in and consult and told the nation not to go in. And then you had, remember, Caleb and Joshua, they were willing to go in because they were responding on faith. God will lead us in. And we're not going to get into all that, but just look what they find there. Look at verse 23, Numbers 13:23, and they ascended, verse 23, and they came unto the brook of Eshcol and cut down from thence a branch from one cluster of grapes, and they bare it between two upon a staff. This is what Israel's supposed to look like. This is the way Israel's supposed to be established. This was such a big cluster of grapes, it took two men to carry it. And they brought of the pomegranates. They brought overflowing with pomegranates in here, and of figs. And you see, these physical blessings in Israel's prophetic program were the sign of spiritual health in the land. They were supposed to be representative that they were participating in the spiritual blessings of God, and he would bestow upon them the blessings of that law. That's the way it's supposed to look. Jesus gets into Jerusalem and he goes to a fig tree and there's no fruit. It's barren. When we got in, we're in Matthew 4. Remember the whole preface to basically almost the whole book of, certainly the whole of Christ's earthly ministry. What does Matthew preface that with? He gives you an account of the state of the nation. It was full of devils. It's full of illness. It's full of hunger. It's full of thirst. It's full of inequality. It's full of all that. That's what with the Israel of Jesus' day. There was no shalom, no peace, no well-being in the land, no spiritual well-being, no physical well-being, no social well-being. This is the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be overflowing with fruit. There's not supposed to be hunger in the land. There's not supposed to be thirst. There's not supposed to be sickness. Certainly, there's not supposed to be devils in the land. Go over to Deuteronomy. Just flip a couple more books over. Deuteronomy 8. And you'll see this is just more on the fig thing. Deuteronomy 8, verse 7. Deuteronomy 8, verse 7. For the Lord thy God bringeth thee into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and depths that spring out of the valleys, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees. There's our fig trees. And pomegranates, a land of oil, olive and honey, a land wherein thou shalt eat bread without scarceness. Thou shalt not lack anything in it. A land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you may dig brass. When thou hast eaten and art full, thou shalt bless the Lord thy God for the good land which he has given you. But that's the very thing the Israel of Jesus' day is not. Look at verse 11, and this is why. After all that, he says, verse 11, beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God in not keeping his commandments and his judgments and his statutes, which I command thee this day. That's the problem in Israel. They've forgotten the Lord. That's why that fig tree is up there barren. They've forgotten the Lord. They're doing all the external works that the priesthood's always done, but they're not doing it from a heart of faith in the Lord. It's a barren fig tree. And Jesus curses it, and it withers. Go to 1 Kings. We'll just look at one more thing here. 1 Kings, we just see, what does the future hold for Israel? 1 Kings 4:25. 1 Kings 4:25. Here we have a picture of what the kingdom looked like in Solomon's day. Remember, this is the high point, David and Solomon's, at least the first part of Solomon's reign. You reach the high point, the furthest expanses of Israel that they've ever had in their history, and won't have the full until they get out in that kingdom. But look at verse 25. Okay, so we're in the reign of Solomon. Everything's going great. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, from Dan even to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. That's the way it's supposed to work. What was happening, do you remember from earlier in our Matthew study, what was happening in the area, the ancient area of Dan, in the days of Jesus? Remember when Jesus crossed the sea with his disciples? What did he go do? He had to go into the area of Dan. And what did he do there? He had to destroy the satanic armies, the legion of devils. He's up in Dan. He goes to Dan. Solomon says Dan is supposed to be part of the blessing. And Jesus has to go up into Dan and destroy the legions of devils that were in the land. See, the nation of Israel is completely ruined in Jesus' day. They've had hundreds of years to cover it up, to whitewash it, to package it better. But it's just in ruins. It's in ruins. It's a withered fig tree. Now, is this God's fault? We just read in Deuteronomy that it's because they left him. But let's see what Isaiah says about this. Go to Isaiah 5 and look at God's astonishment. Now, Isaiah 5 doesn't specifically mention a fig tree, but it mentions the vineyard and the fruit. And I thought, let's just take a look at that. Look at the Lord's astounding statements here. Look at chapter 5, Isaiah 5. Isaiah chapter 5, we'll just begin at verse 1. And listen to the song. He's going to sing a song to his well-beloved who has a vineyard. Now I will sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved has a vineyard and a very, what kind of hill? Fruitful hill. Jesus just went to that hill in Matthew 21 and there was no fruit. There was no fruit. It's supposed to be, he planted them on a fruitful hill. Why a hill full of fruit? And yet Jesus gets there and there's no fruit. Verse 2. And look at all the things that the Lord did with his vineyard. He fenced it in to protect it from enemies. And he gathered out the stones. He cleared all. He prepared the soil, the ground thereof, and planted it with the choicest vines. He picked all his vines and picked the ones that would give him the highest quality fruit, and built a tower in the midst of it so he could watch and see what's going on. And also in a wine press there, he's ready to collect the enormous grapes that come from his vines and bring them and put them in that wine press. He's ready to collect the fruit. He's ready to make use of the fruit. But look what happened. And he has a wine press. He's done all this for them. He's prepared the ground. He's watered it. He's manured it. He's cleared it of stones. He's fenced it in. He's watching it. He's going to collect his fruit and all that's there and all it brought forth. It wasn't grapes, it brought forth wild grapes. Instead of those nice, juicy, plump ones you see at the grocery store, it was these little ones that look kind of like blueberries, kind of shriveled up little blueberry-like size things. They couldn't do anything with them. And now, verse 3, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you, between me and my vineyard, what could have been done more to my vineyard than that which I have done in it? He says, I've done so much. And you see why this is so important to understand. Paul actually brings this up in Romans 3, 19 and 20. He's going to you, what more could I have done? Israel had all these privileges, all these blessings. They had the presence of God, the word of God. They had all these, the system of religious, they had everything. And they still couldn't produce any fruit through the flesh. That's the great lesson. And if even Israel couldn't produce righteousness through the flesh before God, then no other nation is going to be able to. No other nation had the resources she had. And if she can't, no one can. That's Paul's point in Romans 3:19 and 20. And he says, what more could I have done for you? All that I've done to prepare you. And he says, wherefore, when I looked, verse 4, that it should bring forth grapes, it just brought forth wild grapes. And now go to, now I'll tell you what I will do with my vineyard. I will take away the hedge, and I will, and it shall be eaten up, and break down the wall, and it shall be trodden down, and I will lay it waste. It shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. I will also command the clouds that they rain no more upon it. For the vineyard of the Lord of the hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah his pleasant plant. And he looked for judgment, but behold, oppression, for righteousness. But behold, a cry. He goes out, he's planted it, he's watered it, he's cared for it, he's protected it, he's given it all these advantages, he's chosen the... And all they produce is wild grapes. What more could he have done? And so he's going to... And of course in Isaiah here, this is not talking about San Francisco or New Orleans or New York or any place else. This has nothing to do with what's going on today. He tells you who the vineyard is. It's the nation of Israel. It's Israel is his vineyard. And he's going to now hand them over to the Babylonians. And the Babylonians are going to come down and take them captive and remove them from the land. What more could he have done? This fruitful hill, he planted this vineyard, these fig trees, these pomegranates on this fruitful hill. Jesus comes to this fruitful hill and there's no fruit. Now, where did Jesus come from? I think this is an important thing that sets the background. How did this whole account begin? Where did Jesus collect and meet with his disciples? Where did he come and go when he was meeting, regathering with his disciples? He went up, left the temple, left the city, went up on Mount of Olives, and where did he go? Bethphage, Bethany area. And what's Bethphage? Bethphage is the house of the green figs, the house of the unripened figs. He leaves Jerusalem with a withered fig tree that bears no fruit whatsoever, and he takes his disciples up to the house of green figs. That believing remnant is bearing fruit. It has the green buds, and now it's just going to leaf out, and they will develop their fruit in that tribulation period, well, after the resurrection here and the tribulation, especially in that kingdom. All right, so let's go and look at a few other things here. So that's what he's done, everything he could do. Israel is supposed to be a fruitful land, and figs, and those are supposed to be representative of a land and a people in a right relationship with God. And instead, they were in a wrong relationship with God, and now Jesus comes, and it's a withered fig tree. Let's look at another example on our way through here. Let's go from Isaiah to Jeremiah. Jeremiah 8, next book over, Jeremiah 8. And let's just look. Now remember where these fall. You can't just go and put American history in here or world history or anything else in here. Isaiah was talking about the coming Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. Now when you get to Jeremiah, the Assyrian captivity is over. They've already come and taken the northern kingdom and they've been scattered out and among the nations. The next thing on the list for Jeremiah is now the Babylonian captivity is coming. He's actually going to live through it. He's actually there when it happens. That's what he's going to be talking about. That's what he's going to be prophesying about. So let's look at Jeremiah 8 with that little bit of background. And look at Jeremiah 8, verse 8. How do you say then, we are wise, and the law of the Lord is with us? See, he's mocking the vain religious system in his day. This is Jeremiah. Isaiah did the same thing in his day, and it hasn't gotten any better now that we're to Jeremiah. How can you say we're doing the law of the Lord? How can you say how we are wise and the law, verse 8, of the Lord is with us? Lo, certainly in vain made he it. The pen of the scribes is in vain. You want to know why? Throughout the book of Matthew, we've been calling the rulers in Israel the vain religious system. Well, here's the reason. One of the reasons. It's a vain to using the law. They're claiming to be wise. They claim to know the things of God. They claim to be have the law and be teachers of the law. They claim to be, but they're not doing the law. They're not doing it out of a heart of faith and love. Of course, the love in the law, what's the greatest love in the law? Love thy neighbor as thyself. And he's bringing this out. You're not doing that. You're oppressing. Let's keep reading. Lo, it's all in vain at the verse 8. The scribes are operating in vain, yet they claim to be the wise men. The wise men are shamed and they are dismayed and taken. That's what they should be doing. Lo, they have rejected the word of the Lord. And what wisdom is in that? Several times in Matthew, we brought this out. Matthew over and over attacks the vain religious system, and he demonstrates, we saw this with regard to the Sabbath, we saw this how they handled the law in the Sermon on the Mount, how they handled the Sabbath later in the book of Matthew and many other times. And he's showing, see, this vain religious system, my believing remnant, you have to understand, Peter and the 12, and the, you have to understand, this vain religious system doesn't know anything about God or his law. He doesn't. They don't know how to implement the law. They're sitting there counting seeds of cumin so they know what to tithe, and they're not being merciful and loving. They go to the Sabbath and they say, no work, no it can be done, and they prolong suffering. God's intent for the Sabbath wasn't to prolong suffering. It was bring refreshment. They don't know what God's purpose is. They don't understand anything he's doing. That's why they needed to listen to Jesus and stop listening to that vain religious system. And here this goes all the way back to Jeremiah, all the way back to Isaiah. They claim to be the wise men of God, and yet they don't know anything. Verse 10, therefore will I give their wives unto others. He's talking about the Babylonian captivity now. And their fields to them that shall inherit them. For every one from the least, even unto the greatest, is given to covetousness. What did Jesus just call that, the system that was ruling that temple in Matthew 21? A den of thieves. Well, what's another, what are dens of thieves? They're coveting things of others, right? It's a covet. They're just from low to high, there's just a covetous system, a den of thieves. And he says, covetousness, verse 10, the end of verse 10, from the prophet even unto the priest, everyone deals falsely. For they have healed the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Were they ashamed when they had committed abomination? Nay, they were not at all ashamed, neither could they blush. Therefore shall they fall among them that fall. In the time of their visitation, the Lord shall cast them down, saith the Lord. And as they come and their nation is in complete ruin, like it is in Jesus' day, what do the vain religious say? Everything's okay. Everything's fine. We got everything under control. God hasn't spoken to us for 400 years. Instead of asking, well, why hasn't God spoken to you for 400 years? Maybe because of your rebelliousness. No, they say God hasn't spoken to us for 400 years, so that must mean he's real happy with the way we're running things. So they just change everything. That's exactly what Jeremiah is saying. Peace, peace, everything's going good. Israel has this gashing wound on their leg, blood's pouring out, and they come and put a little Band-Aid on it and say, peace, peace, everything's fine. And the nation just bleeds out. Verse 12. Were they... verse 13, I will consume them, saith the Lord. There shall be no grapes on the vine, and nor figs on the fig tree. And Jesus gets, and he goes into Jerusalem, the capital of the nation, supposed to be God's place, and there's no figs on the tree. No figs on the tree, and the leaves shall fade, and the things that I have given them shall pass. Now, this is a good tie-in to where we're going next after this fig tree. Look at the last phrase here. Very important. So he says, and the things that I have given them, what's he going to do? Shall pass away from them. this vain religious system was spoke. God had given the religious system of Israel all his things, his blessings, his service, his word, his all these things. And they've taken and they've stolen them for their own use. He's going to destroy them. And what's he going to do next? It doesn't say he destroys the things of God. He's going to take the things that they were supposed, this religious system was supposed to be dispensing God's blessings to the nation of Israel. Instead, in their day, they're keeping the things of God for their own benefit. They're taking things unto themselves. They're covetous. They're not extending blessing to the nation. He's going to shut them down. Like he shut down the temple in Matthew 21, like he withered the fig tree. He's going to shut that vain religious system down. And he's going to take away the things of God that they stole. They are usurpers. They were supposed to be the dispensers of his blessings. They've become the stealers of his blessings. And he's going to make them wither away. And he's going to take the things of God that they stole. And he's going to give them to someone else. And you know what the next thing in Matthew 21 is? He's going to take this vain religious system, withers away. The nation that clung to that vain religious system is going to wither away. And he's going to, the things they usurped, the things they stole from God, the things they kept from the people, all those blessings, he's going to take those things now in Matthew 21. He's going to give three parables, and I call them transfer parables. He's going to take the things that vain religious system stole from God and wouldn't give to the people, and he's going to give them to another people. He's going to give them to that believing remnant, his true nation of Israel. That's what he's going to do next here. And so now in Matthew 21:19, let's go ahead back there. Matthew 21:19, and let's pick it up at that point. So now with that background, we see what the nation is supposed to do. This fig tree is symbolic. It's supposed to be bearing fruit. The whole land is supposed to be bearing fruit, but the whole nation is supposed to be bearing fruit. But it's been usurped. It's been grabbed a hold of by this vain religious system. And now God can't work in and through that to produce fruit. See, fruit's different than works. Works, you can be call on someone to produce works through the flesh in their own power. That's what the law did for 1,500 years, and Israel couldn't do it. And they ended up under the curses of the law. Fruit is different than that. Fruit is what God produces in and through you, or in and through the nation of Israel. That's what he produces. You know, when you plant an apple tree, do you really have to do anything to make apples? Do you do anything to make? No, you just stick it in the ground, and if everything goes properly, all of a sudden, later in the year, you get apples. You don't really do anything. Well, it's the same way. It just bears fruit. God works in and through them to produce fruit. It's not their own doing. It's God doing it in and through them. And that's what Israel has been missing this whole time. Matthew 21:19 comes. Jesus comes upon that fig tree in Jerusalem on the way to the temple, and it is barren. It not only doesn't have good fruit, it's not even bearing bad fruit. It's just withered away. It doesn't bear any fruit. It's just a worthless thing. We're going to look at another parable. He says, just get rid of it, because why even leave it in the ground? Why waste good ground space with this? It's totally worthless. Jesus curses it. Withers away, the nation, represented the nation held captive by that vain religious system, unable to be used by God to produce fruit. So in the temple and the fig tree judgments, Jesus removes the life support from this vain religious system, holding the nation captive, leaving it gasping in the throes of death. Now you wonder, well, why not just completely kill it off? Why not just bury it away? Why didn't he just go and bury it? There's a reason. Go to Luke. he's going to do something else. We have to go to Luke to see what he's going to do with this gasping patient that's been taken off lifeline but is still barely clinging to some life of its own. And he's going to do something else. So they go to Luke 13. Luke 13, and we're going to read another parable of a fig tree. And it's, guess what? It's a parable of a barren fig tree. And look what he says here in verse 6. This is Luke 13, verse 6. He spoke also this parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came and sought fruit thereon and found none. Does that sound a little bit of what Jesus just did in Matthew 21? Then said he, verse 7, unto the dresser of his vineyard, behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree and find none. What do you suppose that 3 years is referring to? It's the earthly ministry of Christ. It was about 3 years. He spent 3 years in his public ministry looking for fruit, anything God working at all through this vain religious system. 3 years. He came 1 year, no fruit. The next year, no fruit. The third year, no, still no fruit. That's his earthly ministry. Now look at the response here. And so what does he say? Cut it down. Why cumbereth it the ground? Why take up ground space with it? It's worthless. Get it out and may plant something else in. Get rid of it. Why cumber the ground with it? Why clog up the ground with it? But look at the response. And he answering said unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also, till I shall dig about it and dung it. And if it bear fruit, well, and if not, then after that thou shalt cut it down. In Matthew 21, Jesus goes, he pulls off life support, that vain religious system, and its control on the nation is left just gasping. He's going to start making funeral arrangements, but he's not going to do the funeral yet. He's going to wait one more year before he carries out the funeral. That's the ministry of Peter and the 12 of Pentecost. Goes from the ascension to the stoning of Stephen. He's going to give this vain religious system. He's going to call on ye men of Israel, the leaders of Israel, the leaders of Judea and Jerusalem, one more chance to respond to God and his word and receive their Christ. A 1 year extension of grace and mercy. He's taken them off life support. He's just going to let them gasp and see, give them another chance to respond to him. That's that whole, that they can claim ignorance here. What does Jerusalem say? All in Jerusalem say, who is this? They can claim injury. Jesus is going to pick up on that. In a couple days, he's going to that cross. And you know what he's going to pray up there? He's going to pray, God, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. He's going to let them plead ignorance and give them one more chance. He's going to reduce the charge from murder down to manslaughter, and he's going to give them a 1 year extension of grace and peace to give them another opportunity to receive him, to obey to obey God in faith and receive him through the ministry of Peter and the 12 and the Holy Spirit. That's what he's going to do. He's going to set them aside. He's going to leave them gasping in their throes of death, and he's going to give them one more chance. In early Acts there. It's that whole ignorance concept that's going to allow him to move the charge from murder, deliberate murder, to manslaughter. Because, you know, in the law, there's no provision for murder. Just ask David. He knows there was no provision in the law for murder. The only provision in the law for murder was death. But there was a provision for manslaughter. You could flee to a city of refuge. He's going to let the vain religious system and their followers off the hook in a plea of ignorance so that he can offer it again through Peter and the 12 and the Holy Spirit and give them another opportunity. The bulk of the nation, of course, we know now, since this is all history at this point, the bulk of the nation will cling to the vain religious system and reject this offer again in finality at the stoning of Stephen. That's in Acts 7. That's about 1 year later. It is here that God once and for all does away with the apostate nation, willingly held captive by the vain religious system, replacing it with his own nation of Israel, his own people, formed out of that believing remnant of Israel, who have willingly, in faith, subjected themselves to God. And God can produce fruit through that believing remnant. The first requirement is faith. Without faith, you can't do anything that pleases God. The very first step, as we're learning in our Romans 9 and 10, is the very first step for anyone born in the world, because everyone's born into the world as ungodly sinners on enemy status before God. The first thing before God can do anything with you is you have to believe his word to you. And then out of faith, he can work with you now. And that's the same problem they're having here. They did away with faith righteousness and replaced it with natural righteousness and law righteousness and all these other things. And they missed out on the very first step. And God wasn't able to use them. You can look at this, because we're going to close up here in the next couple minutes, because I wanted to look at this final slide, because it ties into what's going to come next. In Matthew 24, 32, and 33, you have another parable, the fig tree, and that's especially with regard to the signs of the times. And I know, and I've said this earlier today, the whole so-called prophecy teachers, they say that happened in 1947 with the establishment of Israel as a nation. Well, see, that's just nonsense. That's not at all when it happened. It hasn't budded. Now, it's not, the fig tree isn't really the nation of Israel. It's the religious system in Israel. That's not what's going on today. This is something that's going to happen out in the future when God picks up his prophetic program with the nation of Israel once again. All right, so now what I want to do, though, in our final minutes here, go back to Matthew 21, and I want to look at the concluding two verses here. Very important section, because this is going to lead into the parables that are coming next. Verse 21, Jesus answered, back in Matthew 21, verse 21, Jesus answered and said unto them, Verily I say unto you, if ye have faith and doubt not, ye shall not only do this which is done to the fig tree, but also if ye shall say unto this mountain, Be thou removed, and be thou cast into the sea, it shall be done. And all things whatsoever you shall ask in prayer, believing, you shall receive. Now, Matthew kind of just gives half of the story here. He's emphasizing the positive side. Does this remind you? Hopefully, we spent probably too much time on Matthew, the parables in Matthew 18 and 20. Does this remind you of a parable? So keep that in mind. Let's go to Mark. He gives both of these things. He gives the two sides to this. Go to Mark. Go to Mark 11. And I just want to point this out, and then this is where we'll pick it up next time. Mark 11, verse 22. Verse 20. We'll start at verse 20, so you see where we're at here. So this is the same morning, verse 20, and in the morning, as they passed by, they saw the fig tree dried up from the roots, and Peter, calling to remembrance, said unto him, Master, behold, the fig tree which thou cursest is withered away. We've already read that. That's what just happened before in Matthew 21. Verse 22. And Jesus answering said unto them, Have faith in God. Beginning point. Verse 23. For verily I say unto you that whosoever shall say unto this mountain, Be thou removed. Now, when you see that whosoever, you have to read the pronoun that was before that. What's the pronoun before that? It's ye. He's talking to Peter and the 12 and the believing remnant. He's talking to them as a group. Whatsoever you ask for in faith, you receive. Be thou, and he's using an illustration of a mountain here, be thou removed and be thou cast into the sea, and shall not doubt in his heart, but shall believe that those things which he saith shall come to pass. He shall have whatsoever he saith. Therefore I say unto you, what things soever you desire, when you pray, believe that you receive them, and you shall have them. Now that's what Matthew basically said. He was talking about a time when there'd be a provision made for them, where when they asked through faith and prayer, they would receive whatever they asked for. But let's see the rest of Mark. And I'll just say, does that remind you of a parable we've read? Of course, this could remind you of the parable of the mustard seed, right? There, many times in Matthew, parable talks about the, if you had faith of a mustard seed, you could move a mountain. Here, he doesn't bring in the mustard seed concept, but it could go back to that. But I'm talking about the parables in Matthew 18 and 20. Those are the ones that we want to look at here. So here you have, it starts out with all ye in the believing remnant, when you are operating on the basis of faith and prayer, whatever you ask for, you shall receive. Keep that in mind. He's telling them how to tap in the national provision from God. What he's going to take away from that withered up, broken down, turned off vain religious system that they stole away from God and the people, he's going to take those things and he gives them to this believing remnant, his own nation, and he's telling them how to access those national provisions. What they access it by faith and prayer. They'll have everything they need for going through that tribulation period and establishing that kingdom in the kingdom. But now that's what we have in Matthew. But look how Mark finishes it. He gives us the other parable now. That was the parable of the laborers in the vineyard, in case you couldn't figure it out in Matthew 20. Now he gives us the parable of forgiveness in Matthew 18. And when ye stand praying, forgive, if ye have anything against any, that your Father, notice this is ye, he's not talking especially as individual, he's talking about the believing remnant as a whole, just like we see them doing in early Acts. He says, verse 25, and when you stand praying, forgive, if you have anything against any, that your Father also, which is in heaven, may forgive you your trespasses. But if you do not forgive, neither will your Father, which is in heaven, forgive your trespasses. So let's just look here, and we'll stop with this, but I just want to bring out, we'll pick it up here next week. He's going on now. This is like the knot in a bow tie. Everything has been flowing into it. You had those three symbolic prophetic sign enactments, the entrance into Jerusalem, the shutting down of the temple, the withering of the fig tree. Everything flows into this. He's turned off life support. He's all done with that vain religious system. He's going to leave them there. He's going to take away the things they stole from God and the people, and he's going to give them to another people, his own nation. That believing remnant. And he's now explains in the knot of this bow tie how they are going to access the riches of the nation. That's what we just read. Whatever, through prayer and faith, whatever you ask for, you shall receive. And now he says at the end here, this forgiveness concept, now he brings out the second parable, the parable on national forgiveness. The believing remnant would participate fully in God's national provision of forgiveness by forgiving others to facilitate the rebuilding of the nation. And we've gone over this, I'll just say it. If you just think of how how the world handled the nation of Germany in the Second World War compared to how they handled it in the First World War, you'll understand exactly how this works. In First World War, the world didn't forgive their sins, their national sins. And it just brought a Hitler out of it. Then the Second World War, now they say, we're not going to do reparations. We're going to forgive the nation's sins. That's what God does to the nation Israel. They've been building up through the courses of punishment all this debt, all these sins, all these trespasses, course after course after course. It's insurmountable. 20,000 talents of debt. No nation, no individual, no nation could pay. Jesus comes. He takes that to the cross with him. He's going to provide for the nation's forgiveness. So here in the, as we go now from these three prophetic enactments to shut down the vain religious system, he takes the things they stole from God and the people, and he's now in the next part of Matthew 21, in the last part of Matthew 21 and Matthew 22, he's going to give three parables. And they're transfer parables. He's going to take something from one group of people, one individual or one group of people, and give it to another. And he shows them right here how this believing remnant can participate, can receive, can access the things of that vain religious system kept from them. They'll be able to access the riches of God's national provision for Israel through faith and prayer and forgiving others, all to facilitate the rebuilding of the nation. That's going to be their job. And that's where we'll pick it up next time. We're going to next have three parables that transfer things from one group of people to another group of people.